The Black Prince. Many are the legends told in the misty shadows of the grey mountains, the nigh impenetrable fence between the kingdom of Bretonnia and the grand empire. Here was the birthplace of such legends as the infamous Bloodkeep and the vampiric Red Duke, the location of the haunted dwarf minehold of Buralidwar, is said by some to worm its way through the roots of jagged fangs of rock. And here, too, once stood that monument to the dark, the fortress of Drakenfels, and the unholy being who inhabited that blighted place. Some of those tales are naught but stories told to frighten young children, and to keep ignorant peasants from straying too far from their master's lands. But others hold the seed of some dark and terrible truth, some secret the teller of such stories is better off not guessing. For sometimes truth comes at a high price, and can raise the fortunes of the most prosperous, sap the strength of the most mighty, and savage the soul of even the most stalwart. Among the legends of the Grey Mountains, there is the tale of a grim and fearsome hunter of the darkness, a black prince, master of a shadowy kingdom of thieves, bandits, murderers, assassins, kidnappers, and slavers. A black prince who rules from a stronghold hidden within the Grey Mountains, and collects tribute from his nefarious subjects within both Bretonnia and the Empire. Some even say that his spectral reach extends even beyond those great lands, to the cutpurses in Tylea, highwaymen in Estalia, Sartosan pirates, and even marauding mercenary free companies in the border princes pay their tithe of blood and gold to this man. It is whispered that not all of the Black Prince's slaves are human, that in the dark woods twisted things hray and growl their oaths of allegiance to him. And it is also whispered the Black Prince himself is not human, but some creature of chaos, a demon thing set upon the world to cultivate the seeds of corruption and decay, to weaken the bastions of humanity, and pave the way for the next great push by the forces of chaos. Chief amongst those tradesmen who hearkened to tales of the near-mythical figure of the Black Prince was that hard and brutal breed, the Bounty Hunter. Though the Black Prince himself might only be a rumor, the reward offered for his head was only too real. Held within a vault below the King of Bretonnia's castle in Caron, the bounty for his capture was the ransom of a king. It had been kept under lock and key for 300 years, following the notorious kidnap and disappearance of the elf envoy from Afel Loren. Yet even after all this time, no man had ever stepped forward to claim the reward. And so the infamy of the Black Prince grew and grew. The siren lure of the Black Prince summoned that grim and terrible figure, Brunner the Bounty Hunter, to the pleasant land of Bretonnia. And on this epic hunt, I became more than Brunner's chronicler. I became a part of his deeds, a part of the contest between the limitless cruelty of the Black Prince and the unerring ruthlessness of the Bounty Hunter. I doubt if I shall ever feel clean again. The tavern was full, despite the late hour. Peasants spent their meager earnings on cups of watered down ale, trying to warm the chill of autumn from their bent, overworked frames. A down-on-his-luck minstrel sat near the fire, despondently plucking away on a battered lute. A pair of caravan guards tested their strength in an arm-wrestling contest, trying their best to ignore the whiny-voiced mule-skinner who tried to incite everyone to wager their coin on the outcome. An off-duty watchman bounced an overweight, middle-aged serving wench on his knee half-heartedly. A woodsman spread a set of skins on his table, examining them in the feeble light cast by the lanterns on the rafters. Near the bar, a well-dressed merchant from the Empire ordered another flagon of ale for himself and his son. The merchant sported the elaborate mustaches favored by the well-to-do of his land. His face was plump and well-fed, but bore the mark of the weather in the hardness of its cast and the roughness of its skin. The eyes glittered with humor, but there was also a mark of sadness in them, a scar left by years of experience in times that were neither so pleasant nor so prosperous as the present. Otto Kretzer took the two leather mugs from the obese Bretonian behind the bar and made his way back to the table. A younger man rose to help him, but Otto shooed him away.
"I'm not as old as I can't handle myself, you know."
The aging man scoffed. He set the flagons down on the table and let a big sigh heave from his chest as he slumped into one of the chairs.
"Of course, I'm not as young as I used to be either,"
he admitted with a wink, taking a deep draught of ale from his cup.
"As you are very fond of reminding everyone when it's time to load the wagons,"
the younger man laughed. Joseph Kretzer was the very image of the merchant, though not as plump or as well-dressed. A slender branch of black hair curled upwards from the corners of his mouth, framing a sharp nose. His hair was cut short, though not in the military fashion of the older merchant. His leather tunic was not elaborate, but his boots bore a pair of glittering silver buckles that contrasted richly with the simple laces and clasps that graced the older man's leggings. Joseph reached a soft-skinned hand forward and grasped the leather jack. Pulling it toward him, he wrinkled his face. Otto laughed.
"If you're going to take over the route, then you'll have to learn to stomach Bretonian drink."
The merchant sniggered and downed another mouthful of the amber liquid.
"You'll find few enough places that serve beer, and even fewer that serve anything even the lowest dive in Altdorf would dare to pass off as tea."
The younger man pushed the jack away from him after taking a brief sip.
"I may just have to turn to tea,"
he said, ignoring the glowering look the tavern keeper cast at him from behind the bar.
"I don't suppose there would be room in the wagons for a few kegs of decent drink." "And lose valuable cargo space?"
Otto returned with mock incredulity. His companion smiled and shook his head. As he did so, the younger man noticed a nondescript figure sitting in the far corner of the tavern. Otto followed his son's look and focused upon the solitary traveler. The figure was slim, almost obscured by the shadows cast by a support beam and a stuffed boar's head mounted on the wall. The man appeared tall. Even seated, his height was apparent. A worn brown cloak was cast about his head and shoulders, the hood pulled up over his face. Gloved hands rested somberly on the table before him. The lower part of the man's face was obscured by a wrap of dark cloth. The skin above it was pale and shone like marble in the little light that touched him. Narrow eyes, almost shaped like almonds, stared from above the slender bridge of his nose. They were focused intently upon the door of the tavern. His eyes had their own glitter. They seemed to twinkle with an unholy light. There was a menace in those eyes, a stamp of death and violence. They were eyes that had seen death many times. They were eyes that had seen murder many times. Otto shuddered and turned away, drinking from his tankard.
"Gruesome sort," he muttered. "Best lock our door tonight."
"Who do you think he is?" wondered Joseph. "I see he doesn't drink. Perhaps he's a pilgrim."
A sudden look of horror crossed Joseph's face as he considered the covered face.
"Perhaps he's a leper,"
he gasped.
"He's probably neither,"
Otto replied.
"I'd wager he's a foreign mercenary, a hired killer or an assassin. De Chagnay and Marquis Laguerre may have a treaty, but don't think for a moment that it will last. Things will get nasty before too long, mark my words."
Otto winked at his son.
"That'll be good for business. And De Chagnay doesn't have Laguerre's prejudice against firearms. We might even be able to unload a cannon from Null on him when the time comes."
Otto smiled as he considered what profit that particular transaction would turn. Suddenly, the heavy door of the tavern was kicked open. Startled oaths died on the lips of guests and staff alike, as two men strode into the room. One was a thin, scowl-faced man, dressed in animal skins, a heavy crossbow gripped in his hands. The other man was taller and broader of shoulder. He was clothed in a suit of chainmail. The colorful surcoat of a Bretonian knight was tied about his waist. He held a huge-mouthed weapon of black steel and wooden stock. The business end of the blunderbuss slowly canvassed the room as the bandit turned his body at the waist. The room grew still and silent as the grave. The silence was broken by the sound of metal jingling against metal. A tall figure, surely the bandit leader, strode in from the street, his dark form highlighted by the red glow of the fading sun. An imposing figure, he was clothed from head to foot in armor. Boots of lustrous metal rose to his knees, and from his waist hung a skirt of mail, the links of which were so small and fine they looked like scaly hide. His arms were protected by the same fine armor, with long vambraces of dark metal covering his forearms. Sharp spikes marched along the length of the armor pieces, and his ornamented metal breastplate depicted a rampant drake. The warrior's head was encased in a high-browed helm of black steel, with bat-winged veins sweeping back from either ear. A crawling trim of gold snaked above the face of the helm, before stabbing downwards along the nose to form a vulture-like beak. His face was hidden by a featureless mask of steel. Only two narrow slits for eyes interrupted the polished, silvery surface of the visor. A pair of slender, matched blades completed the figure's trappings, one set upon either hip, each sporting a brutal guard of thorn-like spikes. The bandit leader advanced, stalking past the two mercenaries. With every step, the musical tingle of his armor sounded. The denizens of the tavern parted before the advancing warrior, not one soul daring to breathe as he stepped past them. He let an armored hand rest on the pommel of a slim dagger fastened across his belly and slowly turned his helmeted head. His eyes were alive with a cold fire, a subtle malevolence that caused the soul to shudder. Other figures entered the tavern behind the bandit leader, but none of the denizens of the room could draw their gaze away from the black-clad warrior. As the warrior stared at Joseph Kretzer, the boy suddenly realized how similar the bandit's eyes were to those of the solitary mercenary. The warrior turned away from the merchant's son and looked into the shadowy corner where the lone traveler sat.
"It is a very long road to walk," he spoke from behind a shining mask of steel. His voice was beautiful, yet cruel. It was a harsh beauty that had nothing in it to warm the soul. It was the voice of a demon, a sound of the night, the seductive call of the darkness. "It is a very long road to walk," the bandit leader continued, "to find only death."
The lone figure at the table slowly stepped forward, casting the shabby brown cloak from him. He was indeed tall and lean of frame. His garments were of fine black cloth, his boots of black scaly hide. Three weapons hung from a leather belt round his waist: a long dagger, a barbed sickle-like blade, and a needle-thin hooked short sword. His head was unclothed, save for the dark mask that covered his mouth and nose. His skin was very pale, contrasting with the inky darkness of his fine black hair. Sharp ears of inhuman length pointed from the long black locks. An elf, Joseph realized in surprise, though he had never set eyes on one before. The elf cast a chill glare upon the armored warrior. The warrior spoke again, but no longer in words that were known to any in the tavern, save himself and the one he addressed. It was a melodious language, but spoken with great malice.
"What news from home?" the armored figure asked. "Do they still allow that feeble fool to babble and rave? Do our people still bow to impotent beings that promise victories they do not know how to achieve?"
The masked traveler drew two of the weapons from his belt, the dagger and the sickle-shaped spine blade. The warrior chuckled mirthlessly and drew the sword sheathed upon his right side.
"Dagger and glaive," the bandit lord said. "Are there no new tricks they teach in Grand?"
The assassin moved forward as lightly as a leaf blown across a graveyard by a midnight wind. As he came closer, the hand with the dagger shot forward. A bright flash of light exploded from the gem that had been secreted in the palm of his glove. The bandits at the door groaned and covered their eyes. Many patrons of the tavern screamed, clenching their hands to their faces to blot out the blinding light. The assassin leaped at the bandit leader, sweeping the sickle-shaped glaive in a sideways stroke that should have cut through the bandit leader's mail skirt and ripped his kidneys and bowels from his armored body. He moved the dagger upwards, seeking his enemy's armpit, hoping to thrust through the lightly armored joint and stab into the lung. The sound of metal clashing against metal echoed above the moans and cries filling the room. As the bright light dissipated, the assassin found both of his weapons blocked and held by the jagged, thorn-shaped blades of his enemy's swords.
"Right now," the bandit leader said, "you are wondering how such a thing is possible. I am sure that trick has always worked before. But I am beyond the petty tricks of the witch elves now."
The elf assassin drew away, spinning about on his heel. The blades in his hands were a blur of motion, such was his inhuman speed. To the returning vision of the watching bandits and tavern patrons, it was like trying to see a gust of wind. The assassin reversed his weapons, slashing the spine blade upwards towards his foe's neck, in a move that recalled the decapitating skills of the executioners of Harganeth. The dagger slashed downwards toward the groin in a despicable maneuver favored by the man-hating witch-elves of Cain. Once again, the murderous eyes widened with surprise as the ring of metal on metal echoed through the room. His foe had matched the preternatural quickness of the attack, each weapon again intercepted by a thorn-bladed sword.
"Very good,"
the warrior congratulated his attacker with the patronizing tone of a fencing tutor.
"That was almost exciting."
The bandit's leader, armored hands, twisted the swords about, nearly ripping the weapons from the assassin's grip, and the elf recoiled, stepping away from his adversary. He raised his right hand, facing the palm toward the armored warrior, and flicked the spent gemstone at him. Matching the same fey quickness of the assassin, the armored warrior swatted the oncoming missile aside with his sword. The gemstone crashed against the far wall, exploding in a violent discharge of smoke and flame. The assassin did not hesitate, charging forward, a feral cry roaring from behind the mask. The ululating cry caused the onlookers to cringe, many openly crying out in terror. The tall, black-garbed warrior was unfazed. Matching the flurry of blows, the assassin struck at him with his own intercepting blades.
"Ah, one of the secret names of Cain," the bandit leader said. "Is that supposed to make me tremble? Frighten me?"
The steel boot lashed out, nearly catching the elf assassin's knee. He danced back, but this time his enemy followed him.
"I have no fear of your impotent god,"
the warrior leader sneered.
"I have found older gods, better gods."
He lashed out with his sword, penetrating the assassin's defenses and slashing his right arm. The jagged cut bled freely, but the assassin ignored the disabling blow, lashing out all the more fiercely with his left-hand weapon.
"Do you not wonder why the long war continues?"
the warrior asked, the tone conversational, calm and unconcerned by the lethal blade that danced before him.
"It is because the ancient fool who rules us does not wish it to ever end."
The assassin redoubled his attacks, and the armored warrior casually swatted him aside.
"Now, now, you must use your fury, not let it use you." he scolded. "The others who came before you made the same mistake. I drank feeble human wines from goblets crafted from their skulls."
The assassin swept the spine blade toward the armored belly of the enemy, then adjusted his grip, dropping to his knees and trying to slash the back of his legs. The warrior caught the crescent blade, whiffed the tip of his sword, and sent it spinning from the assassin's grasp. The weapon clattered against the table before it fell to the floor. The assassin started to draw the remaining blade, but the point of one of the swords nicked the back of his hand and drew a thin trickle of blood.
"I think the dagger will serve you better than the Lucky Louie," the bandit leader calmly observed.
With a look of withering hate, the assassin bent to retrieve the blade, but as he crouched, his hand darted to the wrist of his injured arm, drawing three slender darts from the sheath there. The assassin rolled and threw the small missiles at his enemy. The swords rang out once again, and the three darts thunked into the counter of the bar where the warrior's deflecting blows had knocked them.
"You are becoming tiresome," the bandit leader said. "The dagger, if you would."
Scowling behind his mask, the assassin crept forward to grab the dropped blade. Instead, he rolled forward, lashing out with his thin, jagged Lucky Louie. At the same time, he raised his other arm, neither so numb nor so useless as he had led his adversary to believe. He gripped his mask, pulling it down, then rushed the armored man. The assassin's mouth fell open, and he spat a black mist at the bandit leader. The mist settled upon the face of the helm and sizzled upon the black steel. The warrior's long blade swept forward, slashing the assassin's hand from his wrist. The assassin screamed in pain and clutched the bleeding stump to his body. The black armored warrior moved forward, sheathing his bloody sword. The poison the elf assassin had spit upon him still sizzled upon his armor, all save the shiny visor that clothed his face, which was unmarked and unharmed. He bent and picked up the severed hand, pulling the Lucky Louie from the nerveless fingers.
"I told you not to favor the Lucky Louie," the warrior said, the tone as pleasant as that of a huntsman consoling a comrade upon a missed bowshot.
The assassin sank to his knees, cradling the bleeding stump to his breast. As he did so, the fingers of his remaining hand covertly worked their way into his tunic.
"Thinking to offer my soul to Cain? Yes, I suppose feeble old Malekith would expect nothing less."
For the first time, there was true emotion in the warrior's voice, a wrathful, wicked venom to his tone.
"Still, incompetent kings should not be surprised when their incompetent servants fail."
The assassin's eyes hardened. Slowly, he worked his hand back from the tunic.
"What new trick do you think to use upon me?" the bandit leader asked.
In a sudden blur, the Lucky Louie leapt forward, thrust through the assassin's throat, 6 inches of the long blade protruding from the back of the assassin's neck. The body slumped to the floor.
"I am sure it would have been tedious and boring in any event," commented the warrior.
The hand of the assassin fell open, and a four-pointed throwing star fell out, edges dripping with a sticky green poison. The armored warrior bent down and pulled the Lucky Louie free. He raised the bloody weapon before his face and held it there for some time as though savoring the smell of the blood.
"When you see Cain," the voice said to the elf's corpse, "ask him why he failed to protect you. Ask him why my gods kept your tricks from disabling me, and why your wicked skills were not equal to the task."
The armored warrior turned away from the body and gestured to the mass of figures gathered in the doorway. A beastman loped forward. Its head was like that of a wide-muzzled dog, its powerful frame covered with greasy gray hair. The creature wore only a simple skirt of braided hair over its waist, and a huge double-headed axe was slung above its shoulder, Iron-shod hooves crunched across the tavern's wooden floor, indenting each plank they struck. The creature focused its questioning gaze upon its master.
"Take him," the warrior chief commanded. "Leave nothing that was his. Sop his blood from the floor and bind his wounds. Wrap his possessions in soft wool. I wish to savor every trace of the smell of Naggaroth."
The warrior's armored head swung around, regarding the beastman again.
"I shall feast when we return and drink the rarest of wines from a goblet made from this one's skull."
A trace of menace entered the melodious voice.
"Ilgrimesh,"
he hissed as the beastman lifted the body of the assassin to his wide shoulders.
"No nibbling."
The beastman nodded his shaggy head and loped back toward the door of the tavern. Other, more human, figures hurried in to gather the discarded weapons and sop the elf's blood from the floorboards. The black-clad warrior absently handed one of the men the assassin's lakelui. The armored warrior cast his gaze toward his followers bunched in the door. They were a varied lot, motley armed, foul-visaged men in grimy armor and piecemeal mail stood beside the mangy-pelted, twisted beastmen. But one figure stood out among them, and the Black Knight pointed an armored hand towards him. The figure stepped forward. He was tall, thin, and garbed like his master in a fine mail acaton and skirt, a breastplate of steel, and a high-browed helm. The helm was open, displaying his finely featured face, its skin pale and smooth like alabaster. The elf bowed as he stepped toward his master.
"Not as entertaining as I had hoped," the bandit leader said.
"It is well that my lord is unharmed," the elf replied.
The Black Knight waved away his minion's concern.
"Such as they will never be able to match the gifts of the dark gods,"
the bandit leader declared, not deigning to look back at the dead assassin as he spoke.
"There will be others, and they shall find the same end awaiting them."
He cast his eyes upon another of the figures gathered in the doorway. He could see the sweat beading on the man's forehead, a nervous twitch in his limbs.
"Still, our countryman came here expecting to meet someone."
He let his voice switch to the harsher, clumsier Bretonian tongue.
"Someone thought to betray me to my enemies," he hissed. "Someone who has not learned how to obey me. I must teach him a lesson."
The sweating man made to run, his portly frame smashing through the bodies nearest him. Before he could make the street, the paw of the huge beastman, Urgmesh, punched the traitor, knocking him back into the room.
"Bors!"
The dark noble clucked his tongue and shook his armored head.
"You have been with me for such a long time. I elevated you from poaching and thieving in the brambles around Paravon, and this is how you thank me? Such a waste."
Urgmesh lifted his massive axe and held a blade over the stunned traitor. His master called him off.
"No, nothing so quick, nor so crude,"
the bandit chief scolded.
"Bind him. He returns with us."
"I must remind him that his life and death are my possessions, as are all of yours."
The dark noble's eyes considered each of his minions.
"To be able to see another dawn because I have allowed it. He must learn that death is a gift only I can bestow. Only when his pleas for death had become tiresome will I consider letting him die."
The bandit leader waved one of his metal-sheathed hands, and two of the watching bandits gathered up their former comrade and carried him outside.
"What of these others?"
asked the elf lieutenant. The noble turned, regarding the frightened peasants as if seeing them for the first time.
"This is an unfit stage to host my skill with a sword, and this rabble is an unfit audience," the Black Knight declared. "Kill them all, and burn the place to the ground." The noble stalked toward the door. As he did so, shouts of rage and fear sounded from the cowed patrons. One of the mercenaries rose, charging forward, only to be hurled back by the blast of the blunderbuss. Before the liveried watchman could raise his sword or push the obese serving girl from his lap, a crossbow bolt sprouted from his chest. Otto Kretzer roared his own defiant fury, but before he could take more than a few steps, he was cut down by the Black Knight's thorn-like sword. As his father fell, Joseph Kretzer lunged forward, his sword forgotten in his rage, and his hands held before him in a clutching, choking grasp. His grasping hands tried to grip the Black Warrior's neck. The knight brought his armored knee upwards, smashing the wind from the youth's midsection. The boy's body slipped to the floor, his trailing hands clutching at the dark armor as his body sank to the floor. When he came to rest, the dark warrior turned and strode towards the door. "Burn this refuse," the warrior lord called from over his shoulder. "We return to the stronghold tonight." The Black Knight strode from the building, paying no attention to the screams and cries sounding from the tavern. He raised his armored head and stared up at the dark, moonless sky. He smiled beneath his metal mask. No, more sleep, the Chaos Moon was still there, dark and invisible against the night sky, but it was still there, watching all that transpired in the mortal world. The Bandit Prince offered up a silent thanks to the generous power that he felt looked down from the dark star of chaos. Once again, the Eye of Char had served him well, as it had so often before. His body trembled as the sorcerous power ebbed from his limbs, and the magical vitality that had filled him dissipated into the night. It was dangerous to hold such power within a vessel of flesh and bone for too long, and the Dark Elf was eager to purge it from him. It was the very stuff of chaos, the intangible corruption that twisted men into beasts, and beasts into monsters. He himself had no desire to suffer such an end. Yet the power had been necessary, no, vital, for the duel. Only with such otherworldly aid could he have matched and bested one of the murderers of the Temple of Cain. That, too, he had seen with the Eye of Char. The elf noble strode to his steed, a huge black-maned stallion, taken from the icy wastes of the north, the blighted region men called the Troll Country. There was something of the ruinous powers about the creatures, for even in Naggaroth, the Dark Elf had never seen its match. It was as savage as any of the reptilians, but without their dull wits and cold-blooded reactions. The horse snorted as its master stroked its mane. He removed a small morsel and fed a scrap of meat to the stallion's fang-ridden jaws. As the animal chewed the flesh, the elf wondered what thoughts stirred within its head. Was it still a horse in its mind, or was it now something else? How much of the Dark One's favors could one command before one was no more? Did he command the power, or did it command him? The noble shook his head. They were the old thoughts, the old fears. He was Jushai for him. There should be no fear. He had seen mere humans wield the power, so how could he doubt his own command of it? The Eye of Char was his. He was not the eyes. The bandit leader lifted himself into the saddle and turned his steed's head. He looked back at the tavern and watched the first tongues of flame lick about the windows. He watched his slaves hurry from the building and mount their own horses. He gestured with his hand, and the entire force galloped away from the burning structure. Once again, his enemies in his homeland had sought to strike him down. Even after 300 years, they still remembered him. He sighed.
He had been among humans too long. For them, 300 years was almost beyond their ability to imagine. For elves, it was nothing but the space between youth and manhood. As he had said, there would be others. There would always be others, for his enemies would never forget him. They would never forget the Black Prince. A ragged form crawled from the burning tavern, taking in the dull, dirty faces that watched the building burn. He wormed his way into the street and rolled about in the mud to smother the flames that rose from his garments. The peasants and tradesmen considered the survivor with expressionless looks. None of them moved to help the man, just as none of them moved to fight the fire that was consuming the tavern. Joseph Kretzer rose to his knees and glared at the spectators. He opened his mouth to hurl abuse upon the craven mob, but only a racking cough escaped his lungs. As he coughed, he became fully aware of the object he clutched in his hand, the long, thin blade in the curious black fishskin sheath. His groping hands had torn it from the belt of his father's killer after the black-garbed figure had smashed his knee into Joseph's body. The young merchant studied its curving, thorn-like shape. He felt some satisfaction as the eyes of the idle spectators grew wide with alarm, and they backed away from him. He returned the dagger to its sheath and set upon the weapon on the ground before him, covering it with both hands. Joseph bowed his head toward the burning ruin and spoke in a slow, heavy voice. It was an oath to all the gods of the Empire, he would find the one whose blade he now bore. He would find his father's killer. He would bury the Dark Knight's own dagger in his black heart. And he would ask no further favor of the gods than this, that Joseph Kretzer might live just long enough to watch the life fade from the killer's eyes, as he had seen it pass from his father's.